You're listening to the Speech Uncensored podcast with your host, me, Leanne Porter. So each week I feature a topic diving into all the nuances of communication, voice, swallow, and cognition with tangible applications to the world of medical speech and language pathology. Show notes are located on speechuncensored.com and feature additional resources for you to access along with the discussion guide for Table Talk Uncensored, a compendium of the podcast to encourage collaboration and growth with other clinicians. And I'm really excited because my guest this week has created really great questions for you to dig deeper into that discussion guide, so be sure to check it out. Speaking of this week's guest, I'm really excited about it because this topic is what I needed like about 8 years ago when I was getting started. And so my guest, Shazina Shahed, is joining me to share the top 6 things she wishes she knew as a new grad entering the field. I can't believe she stopped at 6. I have like a million things I wish I knew. But I believe Shazina's list really captures the essentials, and I can't wait to unpack each one in our talk. So without further ado, let's welcome Shazina. Welcome!
Hi, thank you so much for having me today. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Okay, so let's go ahead and learn more about you. Tell me who you are, where you are, and what you do.
Sure. So I am a medical speech pathologist in Canada, even though I did start my career in the U.S., and right now I am working part-time in acute care, part-time because I have 2 beautiful little girls at home. And I also recently just started my own private practice for adults across Ontario via telepractice. So that's new for me. And yeah, like you said, today I'll be talking about the top things I wish I knew 8 years ago also, when I first started as a clinical fellow entering medical speech pathology.
I have to dig deeper. So you started out working in the US, but now you're in Canada.
Yes.
So talk to me about that transition.
Yeah, so I am Canadian. I am from Windsor, Ontario, but it was my dream to go to Northwestern. I wanted to go there so bad, and I made it. I'm so grateful that I got to do grad school there. And I ended up taking a clinical fellowship position in Indiana. So I kind of moved states, and then the next position I took was in Michigan. So I kind of hopped around a little bit in the U.S. And then once I had my first daughter, I wanted to make sure I was licensed close to home, you know, in Ontario. And yeah, that's when I made my move back to Canada.
Excellent. Nice. I love, like, I feel like it could be really intimidating to try to move to another country and practice there. So I'm like really impressed when I meet people who do that.
Oh, like, well, thank you.
I feel like it's no small feat. Like, it's hard enough for me just to get a license in another state, like to go through the whole thing of like doing it international. I'm just like, oh gosh.
Honestly, it was so intimidating. And when I was transitioning my license to Ontario, it took me so long because I had to track down my syllabi from grad school, which was years before. So I was messaging professors, messaging old, you know, other students, just to get all my syllabi so I could get my Ontario license. It was a big headache, but I'm glad I did it. And I'm settled here now.
Wow, the syllabi, not even just like a report from the university saying what grade you made and that you actually achieved the degree. No, they wanted to know what was taught in each class.
Yes, and even for one class, they wanted a letter from the professor specifically. And I very luckily had this professor on Facebook.
Oh.
So that was very lucky. I was able to contact them to write this letter for me, or else I wouldn't have been licensed. It was a headache, but
no,
it's done and over with.
I'm legit regretting that I asked that because my stress has just gone through the roof, and like, I didn't even do this.
Yeah, so it was very stressful, and I was a new mom at the time. Oh. It was a headache.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Okay. Whew, that's intense. Well, congratulations for seeing it through and getting it all accomplished.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so shall we begin with the list?
Yes, my list. So I honestly started out with, I think, 12 things when I was preparing for this interview, but I knew I wouldn't have time to talk about each one in depth. So I kind of just picked out the really key lessons that I've learned that completely changed my practice. But I will mention the other ones kind of along the way, if I can just sprinkle them in there, because they're all relevant. They're all important. But I do want to preface this interview by saying I definitely don't have everything figured out. I am a work in progress now, and I will forever be a work in progress. I think as speech pathologists, we really need to commit ourselves to continued learning and adapting as new research comes out. But I thought maybe if I went over these lessons or missteps that I could help some other clinicians not have similar regrets, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because I like the first one that you're starting with, I feel, and you may have this like in your prepared notes about how it kind of reflects your journey just with your Instagram handle and the transition there too. So I don't want to jump the gun, but I do like, if you weren't planning on talking about that, I do want you to.
Okay, you know, I wasn't, but I will mention it because that is a big part of my personal growth and it's something that was very important to me. So I will touch on that.
Okay, good.
So my first lesson or misstep that I had from my early on in my career is that I didn't know really the existence of imposter syndrome. I had never heard the term and I didn't know how prevalent it was. I honestly just heard about it maybe a couple years ago. And for those of you who don't know what it is, imposter syndrome is when you feel like a fraud or you feel like you're not worthy of your accomplishments or successes, or you're just filled with self-doubt. And that was honestly the definition of me early on. And it continues to be to an extent. But early in my career, I thought I was the only person that felt this way. And I truly believed it. I internalized these negative perceptions. And I truly believed I wasn't qualified for the positions I was being offered. The reason why I consider this a misstep is because if I knew that this was a phenomenon or a syndrome, if I had a label to it, you know, if I was aware how common it was, I think I would have gone for different job opportunities. I think it would have changed the path of my career altogether. Honestly, I accepted the first clinical fellowship I was offered. I didn't wait for more offers. I honestly was just so grateful somebody actually wanted me. I was like, wow, I got an offer. Done deal. I'm taking it. And I never negotiated my salary at all. Like, I just took whatever they gave me because I thought I'm not worth this much. But that was a mistake. I mean, we go through all of the schooling. I am qualified. I mean, I do deserve these positions. I made the mistake of doubting myself so much. And honestly, it's so prevalent. Like, I read an article saying that they estimated about 70% of people will experience imposter syndrome at some point. 70% is huge. That's crazy. Like, I had no idea. And, you know, to top it off, I was reading about some factors that would contribute to imposter syndrome. One being perfectionism. And I don't know if you've met any other SLPs before, any other speech pathologists, but we are a whole bunch of type A. I mean, not everybody. I can't speak for everybody, obviously. But a lot of us are type A personalities. So that's one tick against us already. Some researchers had hypothesized it is worse for women. So, you know, we are a female-dominating field. The majority of us are female. So that's two ticks against us. Come on, like, I didn't stand a chance to begin with. And when I was prepping for this interview, I came across this BBC article that said it could be worse for women of color. And I never considered that or thought about it. But honestly, it is so true. I know the listeners can't see me right now, but I have never worked with another SLP that looks like me, ever, in person, not once, in my 8 years of practice. And thankfully for social media, I've connected with a few, you know, online, and I'm so grateful for that. So grateful for Instagram and Facebook and all that stuff. But it, honestly, I think personally played a role for me. In that BBC article, there was a clinical psychologist, I think her name was Emily Hugh, and she said, we're more likely to experience imposter syndrome if we don't see examples of people who look like us or share our background who are clearly succeeding in our field. And, you know, like I said, I hadn't worked with one other SLP of color that looked like me, that shared my background. And honestly, I'm thinking back to like early in my career, I would be walking through the hallways thinking, I have to prove that I deserve to be here. I have to work harder. I have to prove it to other people. I had to prove it to myself. And honestly, I still feel like that. to, if I'm being completely honest, like when I'm walking through the hospital hallways, I have to fight the feeling of feeling like a fraud sometimes. And I think that's why I work so hard for, you know, in continuing education, because I have to keep up, you know, I got to prove to everyone. But I don't know, I just want to tell all the listeners that are out there, you know, you are educated, you are qualified, you deserve the positions that you get, and, you know, go for the jobs you want, negotiate your salary because you deserve it. You know, it's common. Don't let imposter syndrome define your career path. Don't make that mistake that I made.
So for our listeners who might be curious, like where you were able to find other SLPs who share similar backgrounds with you, do you want to shout any of those groups out if they're open groups, like for other SLPs to join?
Oh, that's great. Honestly, it's been through Instagram. Everything has been through Instagram, and there are groups that I just, or there are accounts, specific accounts, I should say, that I kind of just came across. You know, I'm going to look those up for you to get the specific handles, because I can't think of the names off the top of my head, but it has been so helpful. And honestly, if anybody would like to message me on here and they'd like to talk about their experience with imposter syndrome or talk about confidence, please message me, because my whole account is based around trying to improve my confidence. You mentioned my Instagram handle. So when I first created this speech therapy Instagram, I created it to hold myself accountable to my goals. And my name originally was The Unpolished SLP. And the reason for that was because I always felt like no matter how much I learned, how much I grew, I would still be unpolished. I would never be like that great clinician, I guess. And recently I was thinking about it and I thought, if I keep referring to myself in such negative terms and having such a negative mindset, how am I going to ever grow? How am I ever going to, you know, build that confidence? So I changed my Instagram handle to The Polished SLP, just for my own personal reflection, I guess. You know, and it has made a difference. I feel more confident now than I ever have before. It's not great. I'm still working on it. I'm always a work in progress, but it's something that I want to help other clinicians build on and improve on. So please, if anyone wants to message me, I'm happy to, you know, have a conversation about it.
Excellent. Cool. All right. I think that's a really important opportunity to put that out there, because somebody might be listening and being like, oh my gosh, that's so me.
Yeah, right.
And then to have that open availability of someone to go to who is open and receptive to having that conversation is even bigger. So yay.
Yeah, I know. I would absolutely love that. Definitely.
Good. All right. So that's number one. Are you ready for number two?
First one. I am ready for number two. And this one is a little embarrassing, but I have learned my lesson after all of these years. My second misstep is I never realized the steps for effective oral care, like the actual proper steps for oral care. Recently, I was supervising a student and she asked me if I learned how to do this in graduate school. No, I did not learn how to do the steps for effective oral care in graduate school. I did not. It was honestly years after I got my C's. I just happened to take a course on oral hygiene through the ASHA website, and it was like a light bulb went off. Am I doing this wrong? I've been doing this wrong my whole career. Oh my God. You know, and it was a light bulb moment. And from then on, I committed myself to learning more about doing it properly. This, like I said, it's kind of embarrassing, but I used to rely on just oral swabs, sometimes lemon glycerin swabs, no toothpaste, and that's it. Now I know better, so I do better. I know that that's not adequate enough to remove plaque or biofilm that contain these pathogenic microorganisms. And as those microorganisms build, you know, that can affect saliva's pH level. And saliva is responsible for so many things when it comes to health status. So when saliva's pH level is thrown off, it can increase decay, bacteria, and then that can influence your immunity response. Immunity response being increased risk of aspiration pneumonia. And isn't one of our main roles or main purposes to minimize the risk of aspiration pneumonia. So why was I not emphasizing oral care? And why are we not taught this at length and in detail in graduate school? This should be a whole course because honestly, it's very complex. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very complex process, and I am not nearly knowledgeable enough to speak on the whole process of how it affects immunity responses, but I highly recommend that everyone read The Power of a Toothbrush from the Asha Wire. And this was in the handout that I created on speechuncensored.com. You can check it out. But lots of great information there. And then also Oral Care Procedures by Karen Scheffler, and that's on swallowstudy.com. Everyone, if you're in the medical setting, please run and read these resources because it really, really changed the way I practice. You know, I'm no longer doing such a disservice to my patients with dysphagia. So I'll kind of go over the correct practices for oral care very briefly. Read about them, please, in depth on your own. But just really briefly, you want to start with, you know, an oral swab, removing any loose debris on the gums, tongue, and palate. Before, I used to stop there. You don't want to stop there. You want to keep going. Then you want to brush the patient's teeth and tongue with toothpaste. So like now, I always carry toothpaste in my fanny pack. At all times, I have it on hand, just so I'm never without it. And I, you know, before, I never knew the effectiveness of different types of toothbrushes. So if available, a suction toothbrush is really great for those patients dependent on oral care. Obviously, it's not available in the hospital, but if a family member wants to purchase one, you can educate them about it. If a suction toothbrush is not available, then an electric toothbrush is great. And then if not, a soft bristle brush is just fine, which is what I use in acute care. So after brushing the teeth and the tongue, you want to rinse their mouth, of course. Now, if they don't have the oral coordination to rinse and spit, I just use a moist oral swab, a clean one now, obviously, and rinse their mouth with that. And then next, you want to go in with some mouthwash. Again, if they can't coordinate those oral muscles to rinse and spit, I just put it on another clean oral swab. I carry a ton with me for every clinical swallow exam. So mouthwash next, finish off with a mouth and lip moisturizer. So that's what you're supposed to do. And if the patient has dentures, you can gently brush them and then rinse them overnight. So yeah, that's what you're supposed to do. Now I know.
I think I had a question about that routine. Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. So when you're going through and doing this in acute care, where mm-hmm. is the patient? Are they in bed? Are they standing at the sink? Like, what's their location?
Good question. So they're most often in bed, sitting upright, and I usually have like a little basin for them to rinse and spit, or I have multiple cups. I have multiple cups, multiple swabs, but I come prepared. Obviously, with productivity and things like that, it's impossible to do this every single time. But, you know, if you notice a patient's oral hygiene is, you know, really poor, and you're going to give them some oral trials, you're going to give them some teaspoons of water or whatever, you should be doing this first. And another thing that I do now that I didn't even know about before is now I try to assess a patient's oral health status using the OHAT. It's the oral health assessment tool. And it's a free tool you can print off online, and you get a score out of 16. And a higher score indicates poor oral hygiene. So I find this very useful, especially when I'm making recommendations for oral care, let's say 2 to 3 times a day. I feel like other people are more likely to follow through with my recommendations if they see that, oh my gosh, their score was, 9 out of 16. I really do need to be doing oral care TID. You know, I feel like it makes them more willing to comply with those recommendations. So I highly suggest that, you look into the OHAT if you don't already use it. So yeah, that's number 2.
All right. Okay. So I love number 3. I think this is going to be really fun. And I like how you phrased it.
Yeah. So number 3, this is my biggest regret. Oh my God. This is my biggest misstep. So if you take nothing else away from this interview, this is the one to highlight, asterisk, whatever. I did not realize the dark side of thickened liquids and how important instrumental exams were. Instrumental exams being a modified barium swallow study, obviously, or a video fluoroscopic swallow study, or the fiber optic endoscopic evaluation of the swallow. That's a mouthful. Or FEES, as it's more well known as. But I honestly didn't realize how thickened liquids could affect someone's pulmonary health. I didn't know the risks. I was so ignorant about this. And I know this is a hot topic right now, and maybe new clinicians are more knowledgeable about this. I hope so. And I hope this is being emphasized in dysphagia courses today. I mean, I graduated a while ago now. But overusing thickened liquids is such a big regret in my early years. And there are a couple articles that completely changed my whole perspective. It changed my practice. It changed my clinical swallow exam. And in all fairness to me, these articles were published after I graduated, so not entirely my fault. But honestly, I did learn about them later than I care to admit. You know, this should have been something that was like really emphasized in my hospital. The first article is by Miles et al. From 2018, and they found that patients have a greater sensory response to aspiration of thin liquids compared to aspiration of thickened liquids. So think about what that means. A greater sensory response, meaning a cough response. So patients are more likely to cough when aspirating thin liquids and then silently aspirate thickened liquids. So how accurate, you know, was my bedside exam this whole time? I mean, especially for those patients who are at increased risk of silent aspiration already. So think of patients with prolonged intubation, tracheostomy. Think of our COVID-19 patients. That's a lot of them. You know, they're already at such high risk of silent aspiration. Why am I thickening at bedside when they could be still silently aspirating? And I mean, let's say, for example, that, you know, one of my patients, I decide, okay, they didn't cough with a moderately thick level 3 liquid. I'm going to thicken their liquids. And let's say, for example, they're still aspirating and nobody knows it. There are so many pulmonary complications that come with aspirating thickened liquids. This is the other study that I wanted to mention by Native Zeltzer in 2017. So they had these poor rabbits, aspirate either water. They had them aspirate xanthan gum thickened water or cornstarch thickened water. And 100% of the rabbits survived that aspirated water or the xanthan gum thickened water. And only 12.5% of the rabbits survived that aspirated the cornstarch thickened water. The rest died. That's so sad. I read that and it just broke my heart. And those that aspirated the xanthan gum thickened water, you know, they didn't get away scot-free. They had greater pulmonary inflammation, greater pulmonary interstitial congestion, and alveolar edema. So think about their respiratory status after. You know, putting patients at risk of aspirating thickened liquids when we have instrumentals available, you know, why are we still doing this? You know, and I'm not perfect. I want to say this. I am not perfect. I am still learning and progressing in this area too. So it's not to shame any speech therapist at all. You know, like I said, I am still progressing in this area, but I think we should be taking this into consideration. You know, at least when we're doing our clinical swallow exams and when we're making our decisions about diet recommendations. I think there was another study from 2014 by Romano, and they found that the clinical swallow exam had only a 71% sensitivity and 76% specificity in detecting aspiration in stroke patients at bedside compared to when they did a MBS. So we need to be advocating for instrumentals. You know, now I am recommending more instrumentals than I have before. So I definitely recommend that anybody in the medical setting read these articles because it really, really made a big difference for me. Based on these instrumentals, of course, some patients are still safer with thickened liquids, right? Some patients do benefit from them for sure. There are still risks associated with them that I never knew about beforehand. One, dehydration. It's a big one. A lot of patients drink less when they're on thickened liquids and they can get dehydrated easily. UTIs is a big one, and that can result in change in mentation. Change in mentation, maybe they can't participate in their rehab program as effectively, right? So it can have a domino effect. Fever cost can be so expensive, thousands of dollars a year. The biggest one, poor quality of life, is something to consider. And I was going to do a whole section on quality of life alone because I have learned so many lessons about quality of life over the years. So many. I can spend an hour alone talking about this point, but it is very important to consider. And it's important to talk to your patients when you're making diet recommendations. And remember, they have the right to refuse. They have the right to accept risks of aspiration, as long as you're documenting that you educated them thoroughly, of course. You know, in my first position, we used to have like a diet waiver. I don't think that's very useful anymore. We just need to be documenting that we're educating about the risks. I did have a patient recently come in, and this guy was, I think, 93 or 95 years old. And he came in from home on moderately thick liquids, level 3, honey thick liquids. And I asked his daughter, how long has he been taking these for? And she said, 3 years. 3 years, this poor man was on thickened liquids. And I said, okay, like, when did he last have an instrumental study? And she did not remember if one was ever completed. So I'm thinking an SLP assessed this man at bedside, put him on moderately thick liquids, and this guy complied. Not all of our patients are going to comply, but this guy did. For 3 years, he paid for Thicken Up or whatever he used. 3 years. And the first thing I did was order a modified because I could not believe he hadn't been reassessed. Nobody looked into it. Nobody followed up. That's it. So think about those patients in long-term care. Think about, you're making a recommendation, and sometimes that recommendation is lasting them years. So it's probably better to know objectively than to guess. So yeah, that's my advice to, you know, if the resources are available, then, you know, try to advocate for instrumentals if you can. Know that we are not the cough police. And I honestly repeat this to myself in my head multiple times a day when I'm at the hospital. Like, you're not the cough police. It's not just a cough, no cough assessment, and then you make your decision. You have to consider the whole patient, their medical history. There's so many factors to consider. Anybody can say, oh, they coughed, thicken their liquids. But we're skilled medical professionals, so we need to act like it. And we also need to think if the benefits of thickened liquids outweigh the risks of thickened liquids and have that open discussion. And, you know, considering quality of life and maybe even thinking about an ice chip protocol or a free water protocol, if that's something you agree with and if the patient is appropriate, that's something to also consider.
Yeah, I love it. I like that you talked about the cough and like not being cough police. And I've been catching like glimpses of the idea that like reframing how we think about the cough, like it's your friend. Mm-hmm. It's helping clear your airway of the right. foreign substance. A cough is good. And a cough that ejects the material is best. So yeah. like if you're coughing, your body's working. Congratulate it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. No, and that's right. You know, we're coughing in response to aspiration. You're trying to clear it, like you said, for sure. That's a good thing. So that was another lesson that I learned the hard way. And again, I'm still working on this. I'm still progressing in this area, but now that I have more awareness and I have the knowledge, you know, I'm working on it for sure.
Yeah. And I really like how you talked about the dark side of thickened liquids, because I know when I was going through schooling and at my first few years on the job, that really wasn't discussed. It was always like, oh, well, that's the problem. Then this is what we do. Thickened liquids mm-hmm. are the answer. There was no, well, there might be some drawbacks. There might be some like negative effects of thickened liquids. Like it's a balance game, and you have to know when mm-hmm. when they would be effective and when they wouldn't be. And so I like that you clarified on knowing what was most important to the patient, what's their quality of life, what are other involved risk factors, and weighing those things. Right. So that's something that I agree I've learned along the way as well. And I'm like, well, dead gummit, that makes my job more complicated.
No, it does. And honestly, and this is what makes us skilled medical professionals, right? It's not cough, no cough. We have to think about so many other factors and weigh the benefits and the risks and have that discussion. It's much more complicated than that.
Yeah. And even as we're talking about it, like we're just hitting the main points. Like you said, there are more resources that you've referenced and resourced, like that are in the show notes and on the discussion guide, that can really take you down all the areas that you're touching on in this talk, like in depth. So.
Right. Right. And honestly, speaking of all the risk factors, that leads me into my next misstep is I never knew about all of these risk factors for developing aspiration pneumonia. You know, I never used to realize it was so multifactorial. I used to approach it with very linear thinking. Like someone is aspirating, oh, they'll probably get aspiration pneumonia. But not everybody that aspirates develops aspiration pneumonia. There are functional aspirators. So this is why it's so important to look at these risk factors, you know, now I know, and to kind of make a judgment call. How likely is it that this patient will actually develop an aspiration pneumonia?
So I wanted to interrupt really quick, and I wanted you to unpack that statement, functional aspirator, just in case there's someone who's listening who is like, that's a new term for me. I haven't heard that discussed before.
Sure.
Who might fall under the category of a functional aspirator, and what does that mean for them?
So a functional aspirator would be, let's say, someone who may aspirate but never develop an aspiration pneumonia because they don't have other risk factors. Let's say there's someone whose immune system is working fantastic, they're young, they're mobile, they have great oral hygiene. You know, these people may aspirate but doesn't have respiratory complications. You know, and it could be a similar patient who is also aspirating, but they have horrible oral hygiene, their immune system is compromised, you know, they're dependent for feeding. You know, they may be more likely to develop an aspiration pneumonia. So we need to be more concerned with maybe diet modifications or any, you know, other strategies for that patient than the functional aspirator.
Yes. I wanted to unpack like the horrible oral care for just a second. Like when we say that, that doesn't mean someone just neglects brushing their teeth. That takes into account a long, like a lifetime history of maybe they've got cavities, they've got caries, they've had a lot of extensive dental work. So their mouth is kind of already at risk. Like their teeth are either already missing or like some of that dental work is started to erode. And so they've got perfect little pockets in there to increase like more of that bacteria growth. And so they could brush three times a day, but they're just at like a higher risk level because of that kind of that history that they've had. And or they're dehydrated. And so their mouth is really dry. And when our mouth is dry, that helps influence an environment that creates the overgrowth of some of that bad bacteria too.
Exactly.
So it's a lot of things. And it goes beyond just, oh, here's somebody who's just not brushing their teeth for whatever reason.
Right. And that's why I love the OHAT, the oral health assessment tool, because you're looking at decay, you're looking at salivary flow, you're looking at the condition of their gums, you know, are they bleeding? You know, you're looking at different factors and you're getting a numerical value for that. So that's why I love that tool. Because you're right, that's another mistake I made, I think, early on, you know, looking in someone's mouth, I wasn't looking at all of those pieces, you know, but you're right, it goes so much deeper than someone just neglecting to brush their teeth.
Yeah. Or that they have their natural dentition versus a lack thereof, or they're reliant on dentures. Like it's such a bigger picture. And you're right. I really appreciate how the OHAT makes something that can be very subjective, like, oh yeah, you've got teeth, so you must have good oral hygiene, versus like, well, how dry is their mouth and other factors like that. And then it gives it a numerical value. So it takes kind of the subjectiveness out of it.
Right, exactly.
To an extent, I reckon, because you're still grading it.
Yeah, exactly, to an extent. But honestly, I love any like screenings or assessments like that that put numerical values onto things. I'm a numbers person, so anything like that, I'm all for.
Cool, awesome. Okay, sorry, I got us off track. We were talking about the risk factors okay. of aspiration pneumonia. Let's get back on that.
Yeah. I'm not sure, again, if newer clinicians are being taught this in their dysphagia courses or if this is emphasized. I'm sure it was mentioned in mine. I just don't remember, to be honest. And if I don't remember, I'm guessing it wasn't really emphasized. And I don't really remember any supervisors going over these things with me, like things to look at, if I remember correctly. But hopefully now that's evolved a little bit. The first study I want to look at is by Ashford and the Pillars of Aspiration Pneumonia. And hopefully by now everyone's, you know, at least knowledgeable to an extent about the pillars. One being poor oral health status, like we were just speaking about. Two being an impaired health status, so meaning their immunocompetency. And three being the presence of dysphagia. So that's why it's so important to look at a patient's medical history. I honestly take so long doing my chart reviews. I'm sitting there for like 20 minutes diving deep into their history because it makes a difference into my decision-making process. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking for any diagnosis that may affect immunocompetency. And there's some diagnoses that I never knew that had an effect on that, like diabetes, for example. You know, how many of our patients are diabetic? Chronic kidney disease. You know, someone who is currently a smoker, that all affects your immune system to an extent. So I'm looking for different diagnoses like that. And now, again, I know better, I do better. Now I look at lab values when I'm going to assess a patient. So I'll look at their white blood cell count usually and their absolute neutrophil count, which I never did before. As a clinical fellow, I never remember looking at someone's lab values. I don't remember doing that one time, but now that's a consistent part of my practice. And just so the listeners are familiar, any elevation in white blood cell count could be the body's reaction to an inflammatory process like stroke or a traumatic brain injury. And if the absolute neutrophil count is also elevated, then there could be a bacterial infection. And neutrophils are a type of white blood cell for anyone that doesn't know. So I'm looking at both values now and I'm documenting that, you know, in my notes. But there are other factors besides those three pillars. Ashford identified some more later on, Langmore, and I think Bice and Van Sickle also mentioned some other factors. And there's a really great summary about all the factors that can lead to aspiration pneumonia on Eat, Speak, and Think. They have a really good summary, and I think I put that on my handout as well. So just to unpack some of those other factors that you want to look for, some patients who are dependent for feeding, they may be at increased risk of aspiration pneumonia. So think of our patients with dementia. And just as kind of a side note, this is one reason why I like to promote independence with feeding as much as possible. It's kind of a sidebar, but I think it's important to mention why we should be encouraging independence with eating. You know, this can help minimize the risk of aspiration pneumonia. You know, if you're offering total assistance and they're totally dependent on the caregiver, that's doing them a disservice. Yeah.
I just want to jump in there real quick because I feel strongly, like oddly passionately strong about this topic. Like when I go in for bedside swallow studies, like I'm going to hand them, okay, not right off the bat, because there's a lot that goes in. You've already done your intro, your history with them. You've gotten a feel for their cognition level, their alertness level. Like the first trial or two, like I might do it for them, just initially, just depending. And then, like, I'm going to hand them the cup. I'm going to hand them the bowl and the spoon. Like, I want to see what they would do in the most natural I say most natural. Everything about this setup is very artificial. But like when they're in control, like what's going to happen? What's going to go down? Right. Like, are they going to be impulsive with the straw or whatever? Like, is that going to help them or hinder them? So Right. Yeah, I'm like, so I wonder, I'm curious, like how many SLPs out there are 100% controlling the bolus to the mouth, right? Mm-hmm. Or are you handing them the cup, the spoon, the bowl, whatever you're using, like hand them the cracker and see what happens.
Right. And honestly, the same thing goes for instrumental exams, mm-hmm. right? Are we putting the spoon in their mouth or are we handing it to them and letting them self-feed? Because that can make a big difference. So yeah, no, for sure. That's something I'm glad we paused there and added that. Because yeah, that's something that is I'm very passionate about as well, especially for my patients with dementia. I briefly worked for the Alzheimer's Society, my local chapter here, while I was waiting on my SLP license to process, my Ontario SLP license. And that 8 months or 6 months or whatever it was that I worked for the Alzheimer's Society, honestly, made me a better speech pathologist. I am so grateful that it took me so long to get my Ontario license because it just gave me great insight into like a caregiver's perspective or the perspective of our patients, because I wasn't doing speech therapy with them. I was doing a lot of counseling, and it really made a big difference. So shout out to the Alzheimer's Society for that. But anyways, okay, back to risk factors for aspiration pneumonia. The second one, dependence for oral care. We've talked a lot about oral care already. If they can do it themselves, that's obviously even better. Patients with limited ambulation or limited mobility. So if a patient does have mobility, I like to ask, you know, the staff to encourage mobility, especially after meals, you know, instead of just having them bedbound all day if they can, you know, if they're able to. Next one is compromised respiratory system and an impaired cough function. So think about those patients with prolonged intubation that don't have a functional cough. You know, they may be at greater risk of aspiration pneumonia. Anyone with a previous diagnosis of aspiration pneumonia, that's another reason why patient interview and chart reviews are so essential. Anyone with gastrointestinal disease, or someone who is currently a smoker. Smoking is bad for you. Increases your risk of aspiration pneumonia, for sure. So those are some other factors that I learned about in these articles that I had no idea before. So now I always take these into consideration.
Excellent. Very good. Okay, yeah. Number 5?
Number 5. Okay, this is a good one because I did learn about this in my motor learning class in graduate school. But it was in one ear out the other. I didn't think it was relevant, to be honest, which was a mistake. So sorry to my professor. But the principles of neuroplasticity, now I know how important it is to incorporate the principles of neuroplasticity into our treatment. For anyone that doesn't know, neuroplasticity is the ability of the brain and the nervous system to change structurally and functionally. And there were 10 principles by Clem and Jones in 2008. I highly suggest reading this article as well, because these principles should really influence our treatment approach and our swallow exercise program. So early on in my practice, you know, when I was working in skilled nursing, that's what I did first, I would do swallow treatment and I would have my patient do like 10 effortful swallows. That probably did nothing. Honestly, I look back, what was I doing? Like 10 is not going to do much. You know, I need to incorporate these principles to make a functional difference. So I'm not going to talk about all 10 for sake of time, but I'm just going to touch on some principles that apply to dysphagia exercises that Langmore had talked about. And I did not put this article in the handout, I'm sorry, but if you want to look it up, it's called The Efficacy of Exercises to Rehabilitate Dysphagia, A Critique of the Literature, and it's from 2015. So she picked out the principles that, like I said, really impact dysphagia treatment. The first one being use it or lose it. So think about when a patient is NPO for a long period of time, we definitely see deconditioning of the swallow musculature. Then there's also use it and improve it. Obviously, the more you use your swallow mechanism, it's going to improve. So now when I recommend NPO for a patient, very, very frequently, I have them at least doing ice chips after oral care so they can have that repeated swallow practice in a more safe way, especially after oral care, you know, emphasize that point. And before, I did not used to do that. And not only, you know, not only for repeated swallow practice, but also for oral comfort, to promote their oral hygiene, you know, to promote just their quality of life. Like, imagine that dry mouth for weeks and weeks, you know, ice chips at least. And that's something that I started doing more recently. So that's another kind of regret of mine from early on. Another principle I wanted to mention is specificity. And this is why instrumentals are important, because you can't just use a cookie cutter dysphagia exercise program. You know, you really have to target the impairments, the actual impairments, and you don't know those impairments unless you do an instrumental and you can identify exactly what those impairments are. You know, we need to be specific in our exercises. Another principle is transference. And this means that other motor units can learn to participate in the task. And the example that Langmore gave was working on tongue strength to improve the swallow. And this is something that I think goes beyond my knowledge, so I don't want to speak too much about tongue strength and swallowing, but that's what the principle of transference is. And the last couple is what I really, really wish I knew beforehand. Intensity is the next principle. The swallowing exercise task must exceed usual levels of activity and be performed for an adequate duration to have any effect, right? So you have to be intense in this whole exercise program. You can't give, you know, 5 repetitions and call it a day. I mean, you know, now if I'm working on reduced hyolaryngeal elevation and I'm doing the shaker exercise, I'll have my patients hold it for 60 seconds and do 3 sets is what I usually do now. When I first started, I remember doing 10 second holds and for, I don't remember how many sets I did, but it was 60 seconds and 10 seconds. That's a big difference. That's a big jump. I really wish I knew this beforehand. So I wanted to mention that. And then the last 2 principles being repetition and time. And more research does need to be done in this area. I hope they do more research in this area so we know the appropriate duration to work on a swallow exercise program in order for it to have an effect. You know, is it 2 weeks? Is it a month? Is it 6 months? Come on, guys. Like, we need the research so we know how long to do this for. So hopefully, you know, they'll work on that and we'll know better soon. But honestly, my dysphagia treatment looks so different than when it did 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I really recommend that everybody incorporates the principles of neuroplasticity into their treatments and make yourself aware of them.
Excellent. And yeah, those principles are more for just our practice on dysphagia. Like, they apply to every area that we work
in. Yes, 100%. Yes. Thank you for mentioning that. They do apply to everything. I know I love dysphagia. I like to I like to focus sometimes on swallowing so much. But my next point is actually language related. So because I do also love my clients with aphasia. I'm in my private practice too, of course. So my last misstep or lesson that I've learned is about the life participation approach to aphasia. Now, I don't know when this term was coined. I'm not sure if you know. Do you know, Leanne?
I think it was the early 2000s. Like, I want to say, and watch, I'll be wrong. It's okay. Yeah. I'll throw something out there anyway. Like 2007, 2004, something.
Okay.
Maybe. You know, I'm sure it was like kind of in the works before then, like long before then. But I feel like really coming out in the world and like making an impression like across our SLP community and beyond, I want to say the early 2000s.
Okay, gotcha.
But that's that's not when it was born. Like, it's been around.
Right. Yeah. So I wish I knew about this before. And so let me just explain what it is before I go into my regrets, my deep regrets. So it's a general approach to therapy. It's not one specific technique like a semantic feature analysis or the verb network strengthening treatment. It's not a specific clinical approach. It's a general approach to treatment. And the overall goal is to enhance your client's life participation and their quality of life. There's that phrase again. And it's based on the client's preferences and their interests and their goals and what's important to them. And, you know, before I was incorporating my client's interests. I'm going to give myself a little credit. Like, I was incorporating their interests and their goals to an extent, but I was not as focused on it as I am now. I was using workbooks way too often beforehand. And I think I was doing my patients a disservice by doing that. So now I try to make treatment as functional as possible. And the good thing about this life participation approach, you can integrate this approach into specific clinical approaches, if that makes sense. Like, for example, let's say you are doing semantic feature analysis. You know, you're selecting items that are relevant to that person instead of just randomly selecting things. This is why the interview part of assessment and getting to know your patient on a personal level is so important, because you have to build that trust so they can tell you, you know, what their true goals are. You can form these person-centered goals together. So, you know what, this, I apply this to more than just aphasia, to be honest. I apply this to cognitive communication. I apply this to speech, like my clients with dysarthria. For example, now, if I'm having them work through a phrase list, for example, I will have them come up with a functional phrase list of things that they say every day. Like if they have a dog and they always call the dog in, you know, whatever, for to eat, or like if they have a daughter and they call them every day to ask how their day was, or whatever the case may be, I have them come up with their own phrases that they honestly use every day. And I've heard like some really funny ones, to be honest, of things people say every day. Like, for example, one client had their phrase, like, you don't know what you're talking about, was their phrase. And well, okay, sure, that's what they like to say every day. All right, we'll work on it. Or yeah, I've had some funny ones. But anyways, I find it much better than using just a general phrase list, you know, of cookie cutter phrases. I've had a patient recently that, you know, their goal was to order coffee at McDonald's because that's what they used to do every day. And now being diagnosed with aphasia, they were having difficulty. I think they also had some apraxia as well. And so we did script therapy. And we spent so much of our session reviewing the script and working on them ordering their coffee independently and not depending on their spouse. And by the end of our treatment course, they were able to go order their coffee on their own. And you know, how great is that? I mean, we can work on these non-specific general things in a workbook, but they can go order their coffee by themselves. That's fantastic. Like that makes me so happy. That makes my heart smile. So I honestly wish I knew how to be this functional when I started, you know. Mm-hmm. For example, let's say a client, you know, their goal is to talk about their day with their spouse. I might then introduce supported conversation. And you can find that on the Aphasia Institute website. But, you know, that's something I learned about way after. I learned about supportive conversation years after I started. I wish I knew this ahead of time. You know, it is such a great tool. If you're not familiar with it, please go to the Aphasia Institute website and look it up. But there's so many treatments that I know about now that I didn't know before. I think the Tactus Therapy website is fantastic if you're looking to expand your repertoire and learn about evidence-based treatments and learn more also about the life participation approach. Definitely visit the Tactus Therapy website. It's really, really been beneficial to me in so many ways. So yeah, those are my six lessons that I've learned in the last 8 years.
Fantastic, Shazina. Like,
thank
they
you.
Were right on point. Like, I was at every one of those as well. So it is funny, like you graduated in 2013?
Yes.
Me too. We're twinsies.
Yeah.
And it really cracks me up. Like, we've had like very different, you know, college courses and experiences and jobs and locations and probably patient populations. Mm-hmm. But we've all, well, the both of us have like experienced very similar like awakenings to these things.
Awakenings. I like that word.
Yeah. And I just agree. Like, I like went through every one of these. And now that they're a part of my practice and my understanding, they have in turn like improved my confidence in my practice. Mm-hmm. They've improved my job and my career satisfaction because I feel more effective at my job.
That's a fantastic point, honestly. And you know what? There was a point where I was experiencing burnout really, really bad. And I was thinking about changing careers. I was thinking about going back to school. I said, I don't want to do this anymore. And when I made that commitment to myself to really focus on making myself a better clinician and, you know, continuing education and making these goals for myself, that's when I really like fell in love with the field again. I feel that passion again that I lost for a little bit of time, and I'm so happy that I did.
Yeah, and exactly. And it was a combination of connecting with these better understanding of how to do my job more effectively, as well as connecting with other SLPs who felt the same way about the field and had the same excitement and passion about getting nerdy about it and excelling, you know, and always growing and learning. So like you said at the very beginning of our talk, when you started connecting with other SLPs who were like you, who shared your same background and identity, like, I wouldn't be surprised if that also helped you like start to kind of revive the passion for the field. And it helps like to motivate you and keep that fire going when the other things that aren't so great about our field and our workplaces try to chip away at that.
Right. You're right. It's not all rainbows and butterflies still, but yeah, no, for sure. Connecting with other SLPs has made such a huge impact. Honestly, making my Instagram account, it has been like career changing. It's been fantastic. It has helped me stay on track with my goals because, like, I don't know if you know, but I post goals every couple weeks for myself. And before, I was just, I'll get to it. I'll do it later. You know, something else always came up. But now, okay, well, people are reading my goals. I need to actually do them. I need to actually follow through. And it's honestly made such a big impact. And I love chatting with SLPs, like in my DMs. Honestly, message me anytime. I love to talk about what we do because, like I said, like my passion has been just reignited. And I just love to talk about it for hours and hours. So,
yay. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you so much for sharing. Like, sometimes it can be scary to talk about the things that we didn't do the best.
Yeah.
Or whatever, what's the things we did wrong for a period of time, because that's not fun to think about. So I really applaud your strength for coming on here and talking about those hard lessons learned.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was a little embarrassing, but I think it can be beneficial. So.
Oh, for sure. Like I will just straight up be like, I didn't know that. I should have. I do now, you know?
Yep. Right. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Pleasure. So I think I'll just go ahead and wrap up now. How's that sound?
That sounds great.
Okay. Well, thank you again. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
For taking the time to organize your thoughts and create the handout, the discussion guide for this episode. I think it's just jam-packed with really great points to unpack with other SLPs and that group that we're calling like Table Talks that are the compendium for the podcast now. So those resources are located on the show notes on speechuncensored.com, which you can freely access. Our hope is that when you join in these groups of like 3 to 4 other SLPs for a table talk, that you're building community and fostering professional growth, which like Shazima and I have talked about today, like has reignited our passion, has made us feel like we're more effective clinicians. So we want that for other people too. And in closing, I wanted to encourage y'all to write a thoughtful review on Apple Podcasts about the things you've learned on Speech Uncensored so other SLPs can find the podcast and join us on this journey. And I hope the material that we covered today has nourished your mind so that your practice can flourish. All right, now get out there and be awesome, everybody.
Thank you.